Braddon said. That night, Clay drank blue and sank into the trance, his relief surging at finding Lizanne waiting for him, though he was surprised to find her usually neat whirlwinds a roiling mess.
I don't have long, she told him, mind curt and urgent. Here!
One of the whirlwinds swept towards him and unfolded into what at first appeared to be a confused, vaguely circular jumble of scribbled text.
Coordinates,
Lizanne added, pushing a set of numbers into his mind with an uncharacteristic clumsiness.
Ow!
Clay protested, the intrusion sending a pulse of discomfort through his mindscape.
What? No time.
And she was gone, leaving him dazed on Nelfia's dusty plains.
5 miles north along the coast,
Sigurol said, after plotting the coordinates onto his map.
Just under 3 miles from shore.
3 miles is a lot, Skagahill said, especially on a lake as rich in greens as this one.
Can't be helped, Clay said. We'll go out only in daylight, for just a few hours at a time. Me and the lieutenant will accompany every trip.
He pulled on his pack and moved to take one of the ropes securing the raft to the shore.
Best get to towing this thing whilst there's still daylight.
They reached the required stretch of coast by mid-afternoon, towing the raft along the shoreline until Sigurol confirmed they were in the right place.
You don't want to wait for tomorrow?
Clay asked Kriz as she prepared her breathing apparatus.
There's plenty of daylight left, she said,
fixing a pipe onto the pump, then connecting the other end to the helmet she would wear whilst underwater.
Seems pretty simple, Clay went on. Maybe I should.
It's not, she said.
And you shouldn't.
They launched the raft a short while later, Clay and Sigurol imbibing green and manning the oars to ensure a swift transit, whilst Braddon and Preacher kept a close watch on the surrounding waters. Kriz took charge of the tiller, keeping an eye on Sigurol's compass as she steered them towards the required spot. After a quarter hour of rowing, the raft took on a wayward spin, Clay noticing that the lake's surface had become much more lively.
I think this is it, Sigurol said. The chart you drew indicated a circular current surrounding the site.
They pressed on for a short distance until the water became calm again. They had crafted a makeshift anchor by gathering up as many boulders as they could and wrapping them in a tarpaulin bound with rope. Clay pushed it over the side, and the raft slowly came to a halt.
Depth 135 feet,
Sigurol reported, after checking the markers whitewashed onto the anchor rope. Kriz nodded and adjusted a valve on her apparatus, before donning a leather belt which had been fitted with several lead weights.
Green and black, Clay said, handing her 2 vials. Drink all of it now.
When she had done so, he slipped a vial of blue into the top pocket of her overalls.
Just in case, he said.
Kriz sat on the edge of the raft as Clay readied the helmet. Even with green in his veins, it was a weighty item, fashioned from some old boilerplates with the assistance of Chief Bosware. The plate had been hammered into 2 half-spheres and riveted together, a hole then cut through one side and a sealed glass window fitted.
You see any greens, come straight back up,
he told Kriz, who replied with an impatient nod, gesturing for him to get on with it. Clay placed the helmet over her head and settled it onto the padded leather collar about her neck before moving to the pump. It was a simple hand-powered device that would have benefited from an engine, but there hadn't been time to construct one before leaving the Superior. However, Kriz had concluded that a blood blessed with sufficient green would easily provide the required amount of air. Clay refreshed his green before taking hold of the pump handle, the lever it was attached to blurring as he started to turn it. Sigurol moved to tie a rope around Kriz's waist, after which she took a few breaths before slipping into the water, sinking down immediately in a cloud of bubbles. Clay kept turning the pump handle, his gaze fixed on the patch of disturbed water as Sigurd played out the rope.
"That's it," he said, as the rope stilled in his grip. "She's on the bottom."
Minutes ticked by with grating slowness, Clay never faltering at the pump, his eyes tracking the bubbles as they moved away from the raft, and more of the airline was drawn over the side. "This was a bad idea," the words kept repeating in his head with every turn of the pump handle, the growing certainty fed by his still raw guilt over Jack's death. "This was a bad idea. This was..."
"Two tugs,"
Sigurd said, the rope jerking in his hands.
"She's coming back up."
It seemed to take an age for her to reappear, bobbing to the surface a few yards from the raft. Sigurd and Braddon hauled her closer before removing the helmet. Chris hung onto the side of the raft, breathing heavily, but her sweat-beaded face flushed with excitement.
"I found it,"
she told Clay, pointing.
100 yards that way."
"No greens?" he asked. Chris laughed, shaking her head.
"Not one."
She raised her arms, and he and Sigurd hauled her on board.
"Let's go,"
she said, nodding at the oars.
"Getting late," Braddon said, eyes narrowed as he surveyed the sky. "Better wait for tomorrow."
"It won't take more than an hour,"
Chris insisted.
"We should take the chance while there are no drakes in the vicinity."
She met Clay's gaze, an insistent plea in her eyes.
"We're so close,"
she added in her own language.
"Captain's call,"
Braddon told Clay, keeping his tone neutral, though Clay could see the shrewd appraisal in his uncle's gaze.
"She's right,"
Clay said, his desire to get this hazardous enterprise out of the way overcoming his caution. "The more days we spend around here, the more likely the greens will catch our scent." He moved to take up his oar, gesturing for Sigurd to do the same.
"Let's get it done."
Her next dive was considerably longer, so much so that Clay used up a full dose of green at the pump and was forced to change places with Sigurd. Clay's growing agitation was made worse by an inability to perceive much of anything below the lake's surface. However, this didn't stop him continually attempting to do so as he stood at the edge of the raft, staring fixedly into the depths.
"Just gone past the hour,"
his uncle said, holding up his pocket watch.
"Reckon it'll be dark before long."
Clay didn't need any further persuasion.
"I'm calling her back,"
he said, reaching for the rope and giving it two hard tugs. He waited, the rope twisting a little in his grip, but failing to slacken. He muttered a curse and began to tug again, but stopped when Preacher spoke a single terse word.
"Green."
Braddon instantly brought his rifle to his shoulder, moving to stand beside Preacher's kneeling form. The marksman had his rifle trained on what seemed to Clay to be an empty stretch of water to the south, but he had learned by now to trust the man's eyes.
"How many?"
he asked.
"One. Just over 100 yards out." "There'll be more,"
Braddon said, sweeping his own rifle from left to right. Clay tugged on the rope once more, then fell back as it lost all tension.
"Shit!"
He began to draw it up, hands moving in a rapid blur until the ragged end of the rope emerged from the water.
"Mr. Torcreek,"
Sigurd said, nodding at something 20 yards away, Clay seeing a great mass of bubbles rising to the surface. A split second later, the airline began to twist and coil like an elongated snake. Clay immediately began to haul it up, knowing he would also find it severed, even before he got it out of the water.
"Sliced through," his uncle said.
He stepped closer, putting a hand on Clay's shoulder, though any commiseration he was about to offer was drowned out by the boom of Preacher's long rifle. Clay turned in time to see a long tail whipping the surface 50 yards to the south. the water flashing both red and white.
She's gone, Clay,
Braddon said, tugging his shoulder. Clay returned his gaze to the water, staring hard into the depths.
No. Blue. I gave her blue.
He reached for the vial in his wallet, raising it to his lips, then stopping as an image blossomed in his head. Greens, a pack of them gliding through the misty depths, their shapes rendered vague and distorted, as if he were seeing them through scratched glass. It was as clear and real as any trance he had experienced, made more so by the near panic that accompanied the image. He looked at the vial in his hand, still full.
I tranced with her, he realized,
astonishment momentarily freezing him in place.
I didn't drink, but I still tranced.
We gotta go,
Braddon said, shaking him now as Preacher's rifle boomed again.
You and the lieutenant get on the oars. Me and Preacher'll hold them.
Clay wasn't listening, kicking off his boots and shrugging free of his duster, before drinking down full vials of green, red, and black.
Don't!
His uncle shouted, reaching for Clay as he launched himself clear of the raft, plunging into the lake and diving deep.
Chapter 21 Cirrus. Like many older Corventine cities, the port of Cervec had once been enclosed with a defensive wall, long since fallen into disuse as the conurbation grew in size and the empire became more unified. It was still discernible amidst the maze of streets and houses as an irregular semicircle snaking from the coast through the outlying suburbs, but the days when troops had patrolled its battlements were long gone. Its principal aid to the defense of the city now lay in the fortified gatehouses, which served as both police stations and barracks for Imperial soldiery. Two nights before, Cirrus had flown over the port on Katarius's back, and discovered there were 12 of these strong points in all. Eliminating them simultaneously would be the key to seizing the city. He chose mostly tribal spoiled and former islanders for the initial assault, they being the most attuned to the stealth required for such a task. Each squad was small, only 10 fighters apiece, but in an operation of this nature, surprise would offset any disadvantage in numbers. They had been dropped by Reds at various locations in the surrounding countryside, Cirrus choosing a moonless night to maximize the concealing power of the dark. He decided to lead one of the squads himself, something that had provoked concern from an unlikely source.
Who will I eat dinner with if you get yourself killed?
Kathleen asked, her apparent flippancy diluted somewhat by the tick of genuine worry he saw in her red-black eyes.
The operation will be dynamic, he said, requiring swift modification. First-hand experience of the conditions.
Oh, don't be boring,
she chided, pulling her shawl tighter around her shoulders. Her demeanor had remained largely unchanged since suffering the White's punishment outside Melkorin, though any impulse she might have felt towards confiding in him had vanished in the aftermath.
No unwise heroics, she said,
stepping closer to press a kiss to his cheek. Her lips felt soft and warm on his scaled flesh.
We need our general.
They steered clear of roads or marked paths during the approach to the city, moving in a loose formation at a steady run. Cirrus called a halt when the lights of the outlying western quarter came into view. Veilnist had advised that this was one of the wealthiest districts, which meant a lack of people on the streets at night, and, hopefully, fewer patrolling members of the Corventine Constabulary.
Report!
He commanded the other squads, as his keen inhuman eyes surveyed broad, neatly kept streets, lined with cherry blossom and acacia. There was no sign of a living soul beyond the lights in the windows. The other squads all reported an untroubled approach, apart from Forest Spear, pausing to dispatch a farmer who chose an inopportune moment to visit his outhouse.
A trap,
the tribal warrior wondered, sharing his own view of the narrow but empty streets of the much poorer northern quarter.
They must know what happened to Malkorin.
More likely a curfew, Cirrus replied. It's probably been in place since Corvus fell to the rebels.
So the garrison is on guard.
Against their own people, not us. We're likely to encounter patrols the deeper we go. Keep to the rooftops, kill any sentries you find. Otherwise, proceed as planned. He led his squad forward, increasing the pace as they entered the first streets, then scrambling up the wall of one of the larger houses to reach the roof. Spoiled hands were perfect for climbing, the claws hard enough to dig into the brickwork as the muscles of their remade limbs carried them upwards. The squad covered the distance to their objective in little under 10 minutes, leaping from rooftop to rooftop. A few attic windows blazed into life as their boots sent some slates clattering to the streets below, but they had moved on by the time any curious eyes came to investigate. The squad encountered the first sentry only when the gatehouse came into view, a youthful and bored-looking conscript fiddling with the rear sight of his rifle. He was perched on the roof of a shop opposite the gatehouse, Cirrus taking note of his unkempt uniform and unsoldierly disregard for his surroundings. A spoiled islander used his short bow to sink an arrow into the base of the boy's skull, as Cirrus quickly scanned the vicinity for more lookouts. There were two atop the gatehouse itself, but none in the street or enclosing rooftops. Whoever has charge of this place deserves a court-martial, he decided, sending the squad into their prearranged assault plan. His two marksmen took up position close by, rifles aimed at the sentries on the gatehouse roof, whilst Cirrus and the rest of the squad descended to a shadowed alley. He paused for a moment as they prepared their munitions, confirming that the other squads were all in position, then struck a match and touched it to the fuse of the grenade in his hand. The two marksmen fired as they charged across the street, Cirrus glancing up to see the two sentries falling back from the parapet. When they were close enough, he threw his grenade, the smoke from the fuse describing an elegant arc as it flew through the narrow gunport in the gatehouse's upper floor. The rest of the squad followed suit, save for one who sprinted forward to lay his grenade against the building's heavy door. The multiple explosions cast an instant pall of dust and smoke over the entire street, Cirrus leading his squad through it to hurdle the remnants of the door and charge inside. A Corventine sergeant came stumbling down a spiral staircase to Cirrus's left, hands clutching at a bloodied face, then falling dead as one of the tribals slammed the spike of her war club into his back. The other soldiers on the ground floor were dispatched with similar swiftness, each of them too stunned to offer resistance. Cirrus led the squad up the stairs, lighting another grenade, then casting it ahead of him. They crouched in the stairwell, waiting for the explosion, and when it came, charged into the resultant carnage to cut down any survivors. They repeated the process until they reached the roof, finding both sentries dead, each with a bullet hole through the forehead. The entire assault had taken less than 10 minutes. Cirrus checked on the other squads, finding all had met with similar success, apart from one who had the misfortune to encounter a Bloodcarder agent in the dockside gatehouse. The woman clearly had a good deal of experience from the way she set about killing his spoiled, crushing the skulls of three in quick succession before lighting the rest on fire. Despite this, Cirrus considered the assault a success, since the agent had done them the service of setting light to the gatehouse before making good her escape. It's done, he told Kathleen, as she watched the distant port from the deck of the malign influence. Send them.
You see, Marshal, she said,
casting her thoughts wide so as to encompass Moradin's mind.
This is how it should be done.
She shoved Moradin's dark, envious thoughts aside to share her vision with Cirrus, his mind filling with the sight of the army's entire contingent of Reds alighting from the decks of the fleet, each one carrying greens in their talons.
They'll spare the docks and the harbor, she said, just as you asked. We do need more ships, after all.
Veil Mist had calculated a carefully coordinated sequence in which the fires would be set. Cirrus expressed doubts that the Drakes would be capable of keeping to such a complex plan, but Kathleen assured him it wouldn't be an issue. Even so, he noticed she had spent several hours in silent communion with the White before giving the final assent to his stratagem.
It's needed something from me.
The words for which she had been punished replaying in his head as he watched her entwine herself about the beast's forelegs, both she and the White barely seeming to breathe as their minds touched. In the event, the Drakes kept rigidly to their allotted schedule, first setting fire to the market square near the docks, then the houses to the east and west. There was no repeat of the mass, uncontrolled conflagration that had consumed Melkorin. Instead, the fires advanced across the city from south to north, in a steady progression that had the population fleeing before it. Streets became choked with people, some clutching bundles of hastily gathered belongings, others herding screaming children. Those who attempted to flee to the east or west found themselves menaced by packs of greens and forced into an uncoordinated horde, which by morning had begun to straggle in loose order along the region's principal road. This highway led into a shallow river valley to the north, where Marshal Moradin waited with 70,000 spoiled. The first conversions began by the end of the day. Sporadic resistance had flared up in the city, as remnants of the Servec garrison mounted a few desperate and easily contained counterattacks. The Blood Carder agent made a reappearance as the fire reached the grand square at the center of the city. She proceeded to put on a spectacular display of blood-blessed abilities that left a dozen spoiled dead along with several greens. A valiant stand came to an end when Katarius descended from the sky to bathe the woman in a torrent of fire, leaving her a pile of smoking ash on the square's cobbled surface. Cirrus made a well-concealed mental note to learn her name if he ever got the chance.
4,270 conversions already,
Veil Mist reported to the Conference of Captains 2 days later, after they gathered aboard the Malign Influence.
The overall yield is projected to exceed 50,000 by the end of the week. There are numerous villages in the region which are adding to the total. Over twice the yield at Melkorin,
Kathleen observed, arching an eyebrow at Moradin.
Quite impressive, wouldn't you agree, Marshal?
Moradin's eyes flicked to Cirrus before he replied in a colorless mutter.
Yes, an impressive victory, won against minimal opposition.
Kathleen's expression darkened a fraction, and might have led to more punishment if Cirrus hadn't added.
The Marshal is correct. Opposition was weak here and poorly organized. From the intelligence we have gleaned, it seems the city authorities had been rendered into a state of disarray by the revolution.
Some wanted to send envoys to the rebels, but the majority held loyalist sympathies. In the face of mounting discord, the garrison commander declared martial law some weeks ago, apparently at the behest of the local Carder representative.
That heroic bitch you were so impressed by, you mean?
Kathleen said, Cirrus detecting a faint trickle of jealousy leaking from her thoughts.
Yes, he said, seeing little point in subterfuge.
She always saw more than he suspected,
and considered himself fortunate she hadn't yet uncovered his hidden machinations. The point is we can't expect opposition to be so ineffective in future. Word of what happened here will already be spreading. Fear will breed unity. Kathleen lowered her gaze to the map of the region, finger tapping at the port of Subarisk some 60 miles westward.
Our next source of recruits. It's the largest port on the coast, is it not? Over 2 million inhabitants,
Veil Mist said.
Defended by a full division of Imperial troops and a 7-strong flotilla of warships.
The harbor wall is formidable, Cirrus added. Gun batteries on the wall itself,
and a series of island forts defending the approaches. But we have lots of lovely new ships, Gathlin said. Do we not?
We captured 33 merchant vessels in Melkorin Harbor, Cirrus confirmed. But only one warship, an aged customs cutter with only 3 guns.
You're saying we can't take this port?
She asked, voice pitched into a soft, intent murmur as she surveyed each spoiled at the table.
But you see, that can't be right. For I want it, and he wants it.
She fixed Cirrus with as cold a stare as she had ever shown him.
Find a way, General,
she said, before sweeping from the room. Cirrus quelling the surge of self-annoyance for enjoying the perfume she left in her wake.
An overland march will take too long.
Moradin sucked deeply on a short, sweet-smelling cigarillo, the tip glowing in the dusky gloom.
By the time we advance within striking distance, they'll have had plenty of time to fortify their inland defenses. Plus, we don't have anywhere near enough artillery for a siege.
After a week of fruitless pondering, Cirrus had called him to the roof of the dockside gatehouse for a discussion. Any enjoyment of the Marshal's resentment at being summoned by someone he still considered an inferior was diminished somewhat by their shared dilemma. This meeting could have been conducted mentally, for the Marshal had developed an ability to shield his thoughts almost as well-honed as Cirrus's own. Whereas he used fear, Moradin's mental walls were forged from anger. Cirrus could feel it now, though outwardly the Marshal seemed oddly affable as he puffed away on his cigarillo, stubby claws scratching at his spines in gloomy contemplation, betraying no indication of the constantly stoked rage within. So it has to be a seaborne assault, Cirrus said. They shared a memorized image of the map, detailing the port of Subarisk and the 6 island forts that guarded the coastal approaches.
The fortifications were designed a century ago by the great military architect Zevris Lek Ekiv Torlak,
Moradin said.
Clearly a man who knew his business. We'd need at least 1,000 troops to take each one. And they'll be attacking under fire and in daylight, since the landing sites are only accessible with the morning tide.
We augment the attack with Reds, Cirrus said. Assault them from the air and the sea at the same time. Moradin summoned another image, a pen and ink diagram of something that resembled a brick sculpture of a legless tortoise.
These aren't ordinary fortifications, boy, he said. Domed roofs to deflect plunging shot, walls 10 feet thick, and a battery of 20-pounders, which means they have enough range to provide fire support to the neighboring forts. And even if we do manage to subdue the outer defenses, we still have the harbor wall to contend with. As I said, Torlak knew his business.
Are you saying the place is impregnable? Moradin's eyes narrowed behind the smoke as he took another deep drag.
Nowhere's impregnable, boy, he said, if you're prepared to spill enough blood. Your stealthy tricks won't help us at Cervek. This is my kind of battle. Something I think you already know, else why would you bring me here?
Cirrus stiffened a little as the barb struck home, finding himself irked by how the truth jabbed at his pride. Pride in slaughter, he thought, letting the fear rise to mask the self-disgust. On impulse, he reached out to Moradin mentally, coloring the thought with mingled images of the white and Kathleen's red-black eyes. Any eavesdropping mind would hopefully mistake what followed for a shared terror of the consequences of failure.
Do you like this life, Marshal?
He asked Moradin, watching his eyes narrow further as the emotionless question slipped through the torrent of fear.
You are full of tricks, aren't you?
Moradin returned, taking the cue to stoke his own fears along with a fresh bout of anger.
You sure she can't hear us?
No, but we'll find out very soon if she can. Do you have an answer for me?
This life?
Moradin let smoke seep from his nostrils, before raising his hand and stubbing the cigarillo's burning tip out on the palm.
Can barely feel this, he commented. And by tomorrow it'll have healed. Can't deny the gifts we've been given.
Or the lives we've taken. The children now being hunted in the hills by the monsters we serve. We leave nothing but ash and grief in our wake.
As armies have always done, and I never before had command of an army like this.
Except you don't. I do. Moradin's anger rose again, this time colored by some authentic heat, and he revealed elongated teeth in a grin.
For now. She'll tire of you soon enough. I know the type. Beauty and privilege were ever a toxic combination. And let's not forget the fact that she's completely fucking insane.
I know. Something which doesn't bode well for any of us. Moradin's grin subsided into a glower.
You ask if I like this life. Of course I don't. I hate it. I was not born to be a slave.
Nor was anyone. But what if there was a way to free us? All of us? Cirrus felt a sour, despairing note creep into Moradin's mind.
To date, I have tried to shoot myself 6 times,
the marshal told him, playing out a series of memories. A room in Moorsvale, Moradin staring at his spoiled visage in the mirror, a pistol pressed to his temple. He pulled the trigger, and the hammer clicked on an empty chamber. Another memory, this time in the barrier aisles. The cold metal of the pistol's barrel sliding over his tongue, pressing against the roof of his mouth. Another pull of the trigger, another dry click from the hammer. Then again during the voyage to Pharos, then again during the Hill Country campaign.
I did load the pistol,
Moradin went on, as the final fruitless suicide attempt played out. This one only yesterday.
Or rather, I remember loading the pistol, but each time when I looked again, it was empty. Somehow the white knew and changed my thoughts accordingly. If you ever try it, you'll probably discover the same thing. So, how exactly do you intend to free us from a nightmare crafted by a being that knows our thoughts?
I don't know yet, Cirrus confessed. But I do know it can only happen if we act as one. Not just you and me. All of us.
There are spoiled in this army who love their new lives. What for us is torment is paradise to them.
Unity of purpose is the only thing that will free us. We'll have to ensure there are less of them to pollute our thoughts. And we have a very costly engagement to plan, do we not? He withdrew his thoughts, speaking aloud after a silence that had lasted only a few seconds. Your plan, Marshal. Moradin was wise enough to color his mind with a sense of triumph before replying. Kathleen, should she be listening, would expect no less.
Tell me, he said. Have you ever heard of a protectorate naval hero named Racksmith?
Chapter 22 Lizanne. It was only as the blue began to dissipate in her veins that Clay chose to appear in the trance, leaving barely a few seconds for her to share the information she had obtained. The trance evaporated before she could be sure he had acquired the shared memory, or learn anything about his current circumstances. Lizanne blinked into full consciousness, finding herself lying on the stone floor of a narrow cell. The walls were windowless, rough-hewn rock,
and a heavy iron bracketed door barred the exit. The spider was gone from her wrist, and her feet were bare and numb with cold. Her captors had evidently been thorough enough to rob her of the product concealed in the heels of her boots. She rose into a sitting position, rubbing her benumbed feet and replaying the unsuccessful mission in her head. Failure was not a sensation she enjoyed, but rigorous and objective self-examination were a core part of her training. Too long playing the politician, she thought, grimacing as a vestige of feeling returned to her feet. And overconfidence, she admitted after further reflection. It's unhealthy to believe one's own legend. There was a snicking sound from the door, and she looked up to see a pair of dark, hostile eyes regarding her through a small slat. The eyes were female, and it took Lazanne a moment to recognize the blood-blessed woman she had come close to killing the night before.
You were lucky,
the woman said, breaking a lengthy silence. No, Lazanne said, returning the stare, face impassive. I was better. The eyes narrowed and the slat slid shut with a loud clatter, followed shortly after by the rattle of a lock and key. The door swung open on squealing hinges, revealing the blood-blessed woman standing with a pistol in hand. Two burly pirates stood on either side of her, both bearing shotguns.
Get up,
the woman said, gesturing with the pistol.
He wants to see you.
Lazanne was surprised to find herself unmanacled as the woman led her along a cramped tunnel, the two shotgun-carrying guards at her back. They assume I'm no threat without product, she surmised, watching how the Verestian woman moved with an air of studied nonchalance. A foolish miscalculation. Throughout the subsequent journey, she identified three separate occasions when it would have been a relatively simple matter to subdue the woman, take her pistol, and kill the two guards. But that would have left her isolated in an unfamiliar locale, and, unless the woman had indulged the additional misjudgment of carrying product on her person, with no practical means of escaping this rock. The tunnel eventually opened out into a broad platform, set into the wall of a huge, wind-gusted chasm. Looking to her right, Lazanne saw that a complete section of the chasm was formed of a massive, smooth edifice, and realized she was viewing the high wall from the inside. Glancing down, she could see a placid lagoon and a wharf where half a dozen ships were moored. Despite her circumstances, she couldn't help but be impressed by the scale of this place and the ambition of its construction.
Even your protectorate couldn't take it,
the woman said, reading Lazanne's expression.
They tried once, you know. Or rather, they hired a bunch of mercenary scum to try it. My great-grandfather saw them off, then pursued them all around the world so that every pirate who dared challenge the Okanis clan was sent to serve the King of the Deep.
She stepped closer, looming over Lazanne.
So it is with all our enemies.
Lazanne pursed her lips and nodded before placing a puzzled frown on her brow.
Except these days you are your own enemy, are you not? Your cousin Arshav seems to think this place is his by right.
The woman snarled and lashed out with her empty hand, which met only air as Lazanne ducked under it, delivered a hard punch to the woman's solar plexus, then stepped close to snare her other limb in an armlock. She forced the woman to her knees and twisted the pistol from her grip, pressing it to the back of her head. She looked up to see the two guards raising their shotguns, though not with the sense of urgency she expected.
That's very unwise, the larger of the two advised, speaking in an unruffled tone that told Lazanne a great deal.
The blood-blessed woman wasn't in charge of this escort. He was, and he didn't care if Lazanne killed her. She grunted and released the woman, tossing the pistol over the side of the platform.
A weapon only has value if you have the knowledge and intent to use it,
Lazanne told her, quoting a favorite line from one of her tutors. The woman let out another snarl,
hand flashing to the knife tucked into the top of her boot.
Morba,
the larger guard said, as the woman crouched for a lunge. She came to a halt, features quivering with rage. The guard stepped between them, jerking his head at Lazan.
Enough of this. He's waiting.
She was carried up the chasm wall in an elevating contraption. It was formed of a cage attached to a cable driven by some sort of counterweight mechanism. She was sure her father would have found fascinating. Lazan noticed that the two guards became markedly more attentive as they neared the top, the larger one pointing his shotgun at her head, whilst the other leveled his at the small of her back. When the cage came to a jerky halt at the top of the chasm, the two guards kept pace with Lazan as she stepped out. Their weapons never strayed from their target, as Morva led them through the courtyard and up the stairway to the parapet. Alzar Lacaris stood atop a raised turret on the western flank of the crater lip, playing a hand along the back of a large black cat sitting on the battlement beside him. The cat hissed as it caught sight of Lazan, she instantly recognizing it as the author of her current misfortune.
Don't mind Sheva,
Alzar said, as the guards brought her to a halt a few feet away.
She's bred to dislike strangers.
He gave the cat's chin a scratch, then beckoned Lazan closer.
I found myself greeted by a curious sight during my morning stroll, he said, pointing to something out at sea. Perhaps you can enlighten me as to what it might be.
Lazan moved closer, aware of the increased tension of the guards as she did so. Their indifference to Morva's well-being clearly didn't apply here. She followed Alzar's finger to a small, flat-topped island some 3 miles away. The firefly hovered above it at a height of about 50 feet, Tekela pointing the aerostat into the prevailing wind so that it bobbed up and down continually, but showed no sign of leaving.
It's been there since first light, Alzar said. My crew are very keen to sail out and capture it. Should I let them do so, do you think? Or maybe just have my gunners blast it out of the sky?
You'll miss, Lazan said, and then it'll just fly away.
Alzar grunted out a short laugh.
I'm not too sure about that. I suspect whoever has charge of that thing is possessed of an unreasoning loyalty. Otherwise, they'd have departed as soon as it became clear your mission here had failed.
He turned, resting his back against the battlement, regarding Lazan with careful scrutiny.
I think if I tie a rope around your legs and dangle you over the side of this rock, they might well decide to deliver that marvelous contraption to me. Am I wrong?
I hope so,
Lazan thought, suspecting the opposite to be true.
What makes you think I failed?
She asked instead. Alzar's scrutiny faded, replaced by a cold calculation.
You tranced, he said. So it's safe to assume your corporate masters have whatever information you came for. Therefore, I find it curious that the more interesting documents in my uncle's library remain undisturbed. Nothing appears to have been taken or destroyed.
He jerked his head at the guards, who stepped closer, shotgun barrels pressing into Lazan's head and back.
I am not some Imperial Carder fool, Alzar said,
voice terse with harsh sincerity.
I will not play your games or entertain your bargains. Tell me what you came here for and why, or I'll show your friend over there what we do to spies at the High Wall.
Lazan replied quickly. Experience taught her how to spot a bluff, and this wasn't one.
It's quite simple, really, she said. Zanida sent me.
Quite a story you weave,
Alzar said a few hours later. After a hasty explanation on the parapet, he had her brought to the mansion for a more fulsome account. Lazan sat in a chair in the library, the larger of the two guards at her back, and Morva stalking about on the edge of her vision. Alzar remained standing throughout, his gaze occupied by the huge table map of Aradzia.
"What makes you think I believe a word of it?" he added.
"The fact that you haven't killed me," Lizanne replied. "And how else would I know the details of your feud with Arshav and his mother?"
"Ironship spies know a great many things, and they've always been overly interested in my family."
"Indeed. In fact, they were interested enough to employ Zenida as a privateer. She did the Syndicate some valuable service over the years."
"What?"
Morva said, stepping into view and addressing the question to her uncle.
"What did she say?"
"Mind your place,"
Alzar snapped, jaws bunching and shooting Lizanne a glare.
"My cousin's choices did not always meet with my approval," he said, as Morva retreated with a sullen scowl. "But she is truly of this clan, in blood and spirit, unlike her corrupted wretch of a brother and his bitch mother."
"Who now holds sway over the Seven Walls and the ruling council," Lizanne pointed out.
"Council!" Alzar grated out a laugh rich in contempt. "There never really was a ruling council. Just a bunch of puffed-up bilge rats playing politics and failing for the most part. The High Wall had no truck with their empty prattle. Arshav and his mother can preen and pronounce all they want. Forestia has never truly had a government, nor has it needed one."
"Until now. You do know what's coming, I assume? A clan with so many ships at its command will surely have some notion of the threat this region faces."
Alzar turned back to the map, saying nothing, though Lizanne discerned from his deeply furrowed brow her words had struck home.
"Melkorin has been destroyed," she pressed on. "Other towns and cities will follow. Our enemy swells in number with every conquest, and when it has sufficient strength, it will be coming to lay waste to the Red Tides."
He kept his gaze on the map, his expression that of a man forced into hateful consideration.
"When I was a boy," he said after a lengthy silence, "I would watch my uncle stare at this map for hours. There was something about this land that had once captured his soul and never let go for the rest of his life, right up until it killed him. Now you tell me the key to saving us all rests at the very heart of his greatest obsession." He gave a very small, humorless laugh. "And Zenida thought it all just an old man's delusion." Alzar moved away from the map to sit in the chair opposite Lizanne's. "I would like it remembered," he said in a hard, resigned tone, "that at any other time your corpse would now be decorating our wall."
"Duly noted," Lizanne said.
"Take a message to Arshav and Athilda. I'll join our ships with theirs. We'll fight for the Red Tides, but this changes nothing between us. He is still a bastard and a faithless cutthroat who sullies our name, and she is still a scheming whore my uncle should have strangled when he had the chance. When this war is done and Zenida resumes her rightful place here, there will be a reckoning."
"I'll tell them."
"I have three further conditions," he went on. "Firstly, any prize captured by our ships belongs to the High Wall and not your absurd company. Secondly, we receive equal amounts of any weapons produced by your manufactory. And thirdly,"
he turned his gaze to Morva, standing in sulky silence in the corner of the library,
"I require a tutor for a wayward youth."
"What's she doing?"
Takela asked as Morva climbed into the gondola.
"We have a passenger," Lizanne said. "This is Morva, my student."
"Student? Don't touch that!"
Takela snapped as Morva's hand strayed towards the control panel. The bloodblessed woman stared at her for a second, face dark.
This one's a Corventine,
she muttered, voice laden with menace.
I kill Corventines.
I think we both know you've never actually killed anyone, Lizan said. But Tekayla has, so watch your tongue. Go and sit in the back.
Lizan settled herself into the seat alongside Tekayla, buckling on the straps.
I'll explain later, she said. For now, please let's get out of here.
She looked through the side window as Tekayla opened a valve to add more gas to the envelope, seeing Alzar standing in the high wall's courtyard. His gaze tracked the firefly as it ascended, face hard with resentment at the necessary bargain he had struck. However, despite his evident detestation of the corporate world, she still found him a preferable business partner to Arshav and Athilda. She heard Morva issue a small sound as the high wall shrank beneath them, and Tekayla angled the aerostat towards the north. Glancing back, Lizan saw the Verestian woman sitting with her eyes closed tight, knuckles white as they gripped her seat.
Don't worry, Lizan told her. You get used to it.
Morva muttered something in barely articulate and profanity-laden Verestian, Lizan detecting the words, corporate devilry amongst the torrent.
Headwind's pretty strong today, Tekayla advised. It'll take at least 5 hours to reach the sound.
This drew another whimper from Morva, which Lizan ignored.
We're not going to the sound, she said. Set course for the seven walls. You had no authority to negotiate on behalf of this conglomerate,
Athilda O'Canis said in a surprisingly placid tone. Unlike her in-law at the high wall, she possessed the ability to keep her voice and face free of emotion, though she couldn't quite keep the glint of anger from her eyes.
Agreement will require a vote of the board. The O'Canis family has direct command of 30 ships,
Lizan broke in.
They also have clan affiliations with most of the families in southern Verestia, the majority of whom, I'm reliably informed, would rather see you and your son dead than answer any call to battle you might issue. Like it or not, we'll need them if we're to have any hope of defending this region.
Athilda's eyes strayed to the firefly, hovering above the docks of the seven walls. Lizan had descended to the quayside via rope, and told the harbourmaster who came to greet her to fetch either Athilda or her son, refusing his request to follow him to the navigation. Athilda had arrived, along with an escort, under the command of the inevitable Mr. Lockbar.
Bergravine Artonin isn't joining us, Athilda asked. We won't be staying long, Lizan replied. Too many landings deplete the gas reserves. Such a pity. I am so starved of well-spoken company.
Athilda trailed off, eyes narrowing.
So, she said, Alzar offloaded the little bitch on you, did he?
Lizan looked over her shoulder, seeing Morva's face in the aerostat's open hatchway.
He felt his niece would benefit from some education, Lizan replied.
In fact, Alzar had said,
She's no use as she is, like a child with a loaded gun but no notion of how to aim it.
Niece? Athilda asked. That's what he's calling her now. You should know she's not a true O'Canis, just some blessed orphan he purchased from the hold of a Dalcian reaver. With Zenida off on her privateering adventures, he felt the clan needed a new blood-blessed. She's always been trouble, causing discord and being far too free with her body. Verestians are not a prudish people, but daughters of the major clans are expected to display some decorum, if not discernment. Legacy of whatever those reavers did to her, I suppose. Ruin the girl young and she'll stay ruined.
Athilda shrugged.
Leave her here if you like. We'll find a use for her.
Lizan wondered whether it would matter all that much if she killed this woman this very moment.
Only if her son still lives.
We need more bloodlust at the sound, she said, fingers twitching on the spider as she added. Is Arshav here? Gone to the peninsula to gather more ships and fighters.
Athilda nodded at the harbor, which now held at least double the number of vessels than Lazan had seen during her first visit.
We've been doing fairly well so far, especially since the news about Servec broke.
Servec?
Burned, just like Melkorin. Although our enemies have remained in port for now. We lost 3 fast ships to blue attacks just to find that out.
Servec. They're getting closer with every attack.
The total size of our fleet? Lazan asked. 30 ships here and another 200 in the Iskamir ports. Only a handful could truly be called warships.
She settled a steady gaze on Lazan.
We assured the captains who answered the call they would receive mighty and ingenious weapons. They're already getting impatient.
I promised the first delivery in a month, Lazan said, turning and striding back towards the rope dangling from the firefly.
And I meant it. Don't waste any more ships on reconnaissance. We'll take care of that.
It's impossible.
Jemiah blinked tired eyes at her, voice barely audible above the constant clatter of the manufactory. Lazan had been impressed by the progress made in her absence. The place now resembled an iron ship facility, with its long rows of assembly tables attended by numerous workers. The town had also undergone a swift transformation, whitewash covering many of its previously drab walls, and about half the houses now had roofs and shutters on the windows. However, it transpired all this effort had yet to result in any actual output.
You have materials,
Lazan began, only to be waved to silence by Jemiah.
Materials have to be converted into components, and components assembled into finished products. All of this requires organization, skills, and the time to learn them. At the moment, we have perhaps 1/3 of the components we need for a production run of 50 growlers, and half that number of thumpers. At the current rate, they'll be ready in 7 weeks.
He paused, running a hand through his shaggy, unkempt hair. Lazan knew she had pushed him close to exhaustion already, and dearly wanted to order him to rest, but the situation required a harder heart.
What's the biggest obstacle to rapid production? She asked.
Jemiah thought for a moment.
Molding, I suppose. Copper, brass, and steel all has to be melted and poured into molds, and the components finished by hand before assembly. We have plenty of fuel, but the forging facilities here are primitive and minimal, designed for repairing locomotives rather than large-scale manufacture.
Can't the Bloodblessed help with the melting?
Lazan asked.
We've been trying to husband what product we have. Madame Hackigan has a supply of Eastern Conglomerate stocks from Lossamark, but guards it fiercely. Says we'll need it for defense when the time comes.
I'll speak to her.
Lazan turned and started for the exit, pausing to add, And drink some green. You look terrible.
Too much,
Lazan said, stepping back and raising an arm to shield herself from the sparks fountaining from the bulky granite flask.
Want it melted, don't you?
Morva replied.
Yes, melted, not exploded. Watch.
Lazan concentrated her gaze on the next flask and the 3 copper ingots it contained.
Think of the red as a pool, and you the stream that flows from it, she said,
the air shimmering as she sent a steady, narrow wave of red into the flask. The copper took on a glow before the ingots started to sublime into one another. After a few minutes, the flask was full of steaming liquid metal. Lazan nodded to the team of workers, all clad head to toe in thick leather. 2 of them stepped forward to clamp the flask with iron poles, before lifting and tilting it to pour the contents into the prearranged row of molds.
Try again,
Lizanne told Morva, pointing to another flask, this one full of brass. Thanks to Madame Hackigan's reluctantly surrendered product, and Lizanne's employing all the settlement's blood-blessed in the forge, they had quadruple